You can find more information, photos, and advice sheets on all the plants and recipes that we talk about in this podcast by heading to the links in the show notes or on our website at sarahoven.com.
Welcome to Grow, Cook, Eat, Arrange, the podcast of Sarah Raven and usually Arthur Parkinson too. But because today we've got a wonderful cook as a guest, who I'm coming on to in a minute, Arthur's decided to stand down because, as you all know, he does not pride himself in his culinary skills. And so he tends to sit rather quiet when we have our more food-based guests. So he is going to take a non-seat, not even a back seat in this episode, and he will be back for the next one. So our guest today is Anna Jones, who any of you who are interested in food will know all about. But one of the reasons that I really wanted to have Anna on the podcast was that I think there might be some gardeners out there who are growing wonderful, wonderful vegetables who maybe don't know about Anna. And that may be all wrong, and perhaps literally the whole world knows of her, because they should. And that's what I feel so strongly. And I suppose it's because when I'm cooking, increasingly, I feel I want to cook very sympathetically, one, to my own health and body as I get older, and two, to the planet. And I want to be sensitive to climate change and the issues that we're surrounded by. And so the idea of where we should cut our line about beef and dairy, etc., is something that I feel it is a challenge and that we need to think about. And I have found reading Anna's book, which I sat last week next to a chalk stream in Wiltshire when my husband was fishing, and I was having a rare day off, and I just was totally gripped and utterly transported to wanting to cook almost every single recipe in the book. Anyway, welcome, Anna. I've ranted on quite long enough, and I would love to get you to talk about one, and the subtitle is Pot, Pan, Planet.
Oh, it's a bit of a tongue twister, that, but thank you for having me. It's it's just lovely to be talking to you. And yeah, I forever remember our gorgeous lunch in your garden, and I transport myself back then often in my head to your glorious garden. So lovely to be talking to you. And thank you for that incredibly generous introduction. So we'll call it one just for the sake of our of our tongues and time. But yeah, it's my fourth cookbook. So I guess the three previous cookbooks have all been vegetarian, and this one felt like a bit of a shift for me, I think, in lots of ways. I think the kind of urgency with which we need to sort of, you know, make shifts if we can personally in the sort of way we eat and live has become obviously more and more important. Obviously, you know, there's lots that needs to be done on a higher level, on a government level, and those kind of things. But, you know, I always feel good if I'm doing as much personally as I can. And so one really was sort of my desire to bring together the sort of vibrant vegetarian food, which I hope is sort of flavor packed and texture packed, that I love to eat, and sort of weave within that some information around kind of how we can live in a bit of a lighter and a bit of a kinder way. Because I think the sort of sustainability conversation can quite often be, it can be overwhelming, number one.
Yes.
You know, there's so many studies and reports that come out, often with conflicting information. And, you know, one week you're thinking, oh, well, great, I'm not using plastic straws. And then the next week someone's saying, oh, well, actually, plastic straws aren't the problem. So I also think that the conversation is quite often sort of surrounded with a lot of guilt and a lot of perfectionism, that we need to be doing absolutely everything. We need to be these kind of sort of perfect activists. And, you know, really, that's not what we need. We don't need a few perfect people. We need loads and loads and loads of people doing as much as they can, these kind of small, repeatable changes, you know, that still end up with joyful, delicious, connecting food with veg at the centre.
That's what inspired me so much, because, I mean, I wrote a book about trying to be healthy, and as you've said quite rightly in your introduction, you know, that is a lot of pulses. It is, you know, basing it not on meat and basing it around the vegetable, etc. But I really love the way you take this one step further, which is, you know, coconut milk is so easy to use in almost every recipe because if you're not using dairy, it gives you that sort of wonderful richness, which is difficult to find. But I love the fact that you bring that to the fore and that we shouldn't be just chucking it in willy-nilly because, of course, we need to think about where that's come from and all those sorts of things so that it's not guilt. It's just kind of awareness. And I feel you do that in a very gentle and sensitive way. I really like that tone in your book.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I'm not very good at finger wagging. I think the older I get, the more comfortable I am with sort of having a stance and having an opinion. But it definitely isn't a comfortable place for me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I intended for us to go right back and do some of your biog at the beginning. But in a way, we've got straight stuck into this. But if you were to say to people who are hopefully growing a few vegetables or have got access to good, hopefully organic veg, if you were to give each of us, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 pointers of how we can make our food on our plate still delicious, and that is what every single one of your recipes I've tried, I've just been blown away about how delicious they are. So there's no taste compromised here. But how can we make it sort of better for us and better for the planet? What are our easy wins?
Well, I think there's a few pretty easy things. Obviously, filling our plates with vegetables is the first thing, and that's what I'm always going to say. And, you know, that has been proven in study after study as the most impactful thing we can do. So, you know, whether that's becoming completely vegan, you know, which is the reality for some people, or whether that's cutting one, you know, meal, you know, shifting one meal to vegetables a week. I think it's all about starting from where we are and congratulating ourselves on the positive changes rather than thinking it has to be, you know, a complete shift, because that's not realistic immediately for everyone. And so I think obviously celebrating vegetables and putting them at the center is, I would say, the main thing. The second one obviously is not wasting our food. You know, once we've bought it, making sure it does not go in the bin.
Yeah.
I think 30% of the food we buy in the UK goes straight in the bin in terms of household waste. And, you know, once you add kind of, you know, waste from the industry on top of that, it's enormous. And to me, I really think that connection, which, you know, you talk so beautifully about, you know, with growing and the connection with growers or farmers, if you don't have the capacity to grow yourself, I think that kind of fosters a respect for food.
Yeah.
That means you're
so true.
Much less likely to throw it away. So I think really it's a sort of holistic thing, isn't it? That the more we kind of respect and connect with our food, the less likely we are to throw it away. But in the book, there's lots of solutions for you know, quick ideas to stop stuff going in the bin. Another thing when I was looking at researching the book was actually the energy we use when we cook, which is something that's hardly ever thought about.
Yes.
But again, it's about sort of 33% of the energy we use in our home is in our kitchen. And that's a big amount. So, you know, that's the refrigeration, that's the washing up, that's the heating and cooking. Gosh. So being smart with that actually is going to save us all money, but it's also going to reduce our footprint. And, you know, I think lots of the things around sustainability are often kind of considered elitist or something where you need to be able to go, you know, be going to a biodynamic market or having a veg plot or whatever, which is fabulous and fantastic and, of course, encouraged. But, you know, this piece about saving energy, that is really helpful to every single household in this country. You know, there's no one who would not benefit from that. And that's what a lot of the one pot, one pan thing is about, because it's about using one heat source, having one thing to wash up. And obviously, you know, it's helpful in terms of being able to cook easily and quickly as well. So I guess those would be the three things that I would probably focus on. I think as well, you know, thinking about food miles and just having some common sense, you know, if something feels like it's been shipped, you know, fresh, like a mango or some blueberries, then maybe trying to step away from those. But if something, you know, like a tin of coconut milk has been shipped and it is a dry or, you know, sort of ambient thing, then maybe allowing that into your cooking a couple of times a week isn't the end of the world. So, and of course, the biodiversity thing as well, which you'll know much more than me about, you know, just trying to vary the veg you eat, just as we would vary the kind of, you know, plants we grow or flowers we buy.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's very interesting when you say about that relationship. And so the valuing, the greater value that you hold by something because either you've grown it or you've got a relationship with a person that's grown it. And I find that so much it with cut flowers, which is that when I started, you know, everything was flown in either from Kenya or shipped in or roaded in from Holland or whatever. And it was so easy to then just chuck it on your compost heap. And then I started sort of experimenting with conditioning. And in a way, it really is what you're saying, which is that that's been my teaching, is by conditioning your own cut flowers, you can make them last really well. And because they're yours, you bother to go to that extra mile and then they last longer. So it's just sort of better all round, really. So it's sort of interesting how the two relate, I think. And they definitely overlap. But as you talk, I'm scribbling notes desperately because there are so many things I want to come back to. But I suppose as you were talking about the sort of the research for the book and things, it just came into my mind. I wondered how long you'd been writing and thinking about and evolving this particular book.
Well, this one's been taking me much longer than the others to write, actually. I think partly because my first two I wrote before I had my son, which obviously the time was a bit more flexible then. But this one definitely took longer for a few reasons. I think I've really been sort of thinking about this book and writing it for about 4 years. Obviously, it was sort of published and went to the press about a year ago. So it was about 3 years in total, I think. And it took a bit longer because I wanted to be really specific about the recipes. I decided not to use some of the ingredients that I had perhaps leaned on in my other books, like imported things like avocados. And so there was a bit of a shift in terms of the ingredients. Also, I've made all the recipes both vegetarian or vegan. So you can kind of choose your own adventure, you know, to use that phrase, you know, which direction you want to go in. So obviously that took a bit longer in testing and development, but also the kind of climate stuff and the sustainability stuff. Yeah, required a lot more sort of scientific research than I'm usually used to.
Yeah, sure. So
that's what I was writing sort of, you know, at the beginning of this crazy year, sort of last March and April and May, actually in a shed at the end of my mum and dad's garden.
Right.
So, yeah, it's definitely taken a good while longer.
Yeah. Well, it's a more serious book. I mean, I absolutely adore your other books. For the food they contain. But I do feel this book is another step on because, well, as I said in the intro, really, it takes us on a gentle, non-preachy journey of why we need to be on that journey. And I feel it does have scattered through it those really good panels of the factual statistical stuff, which personally, as a scientist, I find very enriching of the book, you know, that it gives it bottom in a sense, you know, it sort of, and I really... enjoy reading those bits too. But can I take you back to the vegan thing? Because I am actually sort of, I've moved recently to being pretty much non-dairy, if not non-dairy, but I'm still quite new to it. And so I haven't yet experimented properly with all the things like vegan Parmesan cheese and vegan butter and vegan feta and all those sorts of things. And you know, I'm a massive fan of a risotto, as are you, you know, that kind of Mediterranean throw together tradition of cooking. But can I really make a risotto that tastes as good with vegan Parmesan style cheese?
Well, I think it's always going to be a slightly different flavor. I'm not going to pretend that it's exactly the same flavor. But I do think, you know, my brother has been vegan, I think, for about 12 years now. So you know, we've had sort of vegan products and the vegan cheeses around in our house and when I cook for him for a very long time. And actually, I would say as a family, I think we're about probably 90 to 95% vegan. We eat very little cheese, very few eggs, but it's something that we haven't quite stopped eating yet. So I do try and sort of experiment with lots of the vegan cheeses, and there's some fantastic, you know, smaller companies doing that now.
Yeah.
Quite a lot of them don't have the same texture, you know, that very hard kind of grateable texture or that crumbly texture of cheddar. You know, you don't get quite the same. And definitely I've not found a vegan mozzarella yet that works. But some of the feta cheeses and the halloumi sort of, you know, cheeses that usually are called sort of Greek style or grilling cheeses are actually a really good, you know, there's some really, really good ones out there. There's a brilliant small artisan British cheese company made here in London called Kinder Co. And they make some really fantastic, kind of really flavorful, really rounded cheeses. So I think it's definitely getting used to the flavor. I think as lots of people now have got used to perhaps the flavor of oat milk or almond milk, yeah, or absolutely, you know, other milks in their teas and in their coffees, I think it's, yeah, going to be, you know, that process again with kind of, you know, cheese and those kind of things. And I was amazed, actually, a couple of recipes in the book, we've used, instead of eggs, we've just used a little bit more baking powder or bicarb and fizzy water.
Wow.
Which has been incredible at giving us the same sort of lift as eggs. And obviously, then it's much, much cheaper. So wow. I think in some senses, there are things, and I actually prefer the taste of those cakes because there's a kind of cleanness and it lets the rest, yeah, of the ingredients shine. So I think the world of kind of vegan products has come on immensely, hasn't it? And
yeah,
I think it's,
yeah,
definitely, totally, it's quite an exciting space, I think.
It's, I mean, as I was reading it, I had a post-it note actually by this riverbank, and I started making my new shopping list. And I've got oat creme fraiche, vegan Parmesan style cheese, vegan butter, as you know, red peanuts is another one, which, you know, good quality peanuts is a difficult thing. But I'm not wanting us to do a commercial plug for anyone, really. I mean, I try to avoid those. But I mean, do you find good online grocers for that kind of stuff? In London, it's easier for you, I guess, to get access, easy access. But do the supermarkets kind of have that sort of stuff?
The supermarkets do. The supermarkets have got better and better. And I think because they've seen this enormous growth in the market, it's definitely been an example of how it's been consumer driven. It hasn't been supermarket driven. They've been responding, yeah, to what people want and what people want to buy. So lots of the supermarkets do have some decent options, some decent vegan options now. But also lots of the sort of smaller vegan artisans are doing mail order all over the country.
Great.
And there's a few fantastic, you know, Farm Drop, have you heard of them? They're a sort of delivery service that access lots and lots of small farms and bring them all together. And they have a pretty fantastic vegan selection as well. So there's lots of options these days. It does take a bit more work though. I'm not going to sugarcoat that.
I'm just going off to the west coast of Scotland, so I'm sort of wanting to take my, I'm taking your book, and I'm only going to cook from your book, and so it's important selfishly for me to. It's really good to know about these things, but it's good for all of us to know about them. But also, I wanted to move on to the leftovers thing, which is a big theme in your book, and you write about it explicitly, and you've mentioned it in your intro there, because I've got obsessed, just as you mentioned you are too, with egg fried rice, or basically fried rice. And I find it one of those things, I actually prefer it. It's where leftovers are better than the sum of its early parts. And particularly now vegetables are getting so delicious with things like courgettes and peas and stuff that I'm able to pick from the garden here. But I was so, it really made me sort of practically want to yelp with joy when I found that you felt the same. And so you cook your brown rice and then the starch changes, doesn't it, to be incredibly good for gut flora and everything, so that it's even healthier as well. And
absolutely.
So not only delicious, good for the planet, but also healthy. So I would love you to just talk through that as one of the recipes. Would you mind if you just, I know it's, you will say it's so straightforward, you practically can't talk about it, but I would love you to just say, if you were cooking up an egg fried rice tonight, what you would do.
Absolutely. Well, it is one of our most cooked meals, I think. One of the reasons is because my five-year-old will actually eat it.
Yeah, yeah. It's very good and comforting.
It is very good and comforting. And it amazes me how much, how often we cook his favourite meals. He's definitely the boss of his,
yeah,
house.
Yeah.
But I quite often will do fried rice. Sometimes I'll do tofu. And if I'm cooking tofu in the rice, then I will start off with that. So usually a firm tofu, I'll cut it in sort of matchsticks, not fancy, yep, matchsticks, but just so it kind of, you know, is sort of thin and cooks evenly all over. And I will just get a pan really, really hot, put the tofu in there, cook it until it's golden on all sides. And then a really good trick with tofu to add a bit of extra flavour is just before you're about to turn the pan off the heat, when it's lovely and golden, to add about a tablespoon, well, not quite a tablespoon, probably a generous teaspoon of soy sauce.
Yeah.
And it coats the tofu in this wonderful way, yes. Gives a kind of crispy outside and seasons it. So if you haven't had time to kind of marinate your tofu or add flavour in that way, that's really great. So then the tofu would come out of the pan. Then I would add a mixture of kind of aromatics, whatever I had around, but usually that's going to be a decent amount of garlic, ginger, and probably some spring onions because they cook nice and quickly, but otherwise onions, and saute that around. And then I would probably add, you know, whatever seasonal veg we've got around. I think grated veg is actually fantastic in this. So in winter, you know, grated roots, grated carrots, that kind of thing. But obviously this time of year, we're so, you know, we've got such an abundance of lovely fresh green stuff. So I think I would probably, you know, probably go with some lovely courgettes,
yeah,
and just saute them until they're sort of, you know, beginning to brown.
Yeah, grated.
I would grate them or probably finely slice them.
Slice them, yeah.
I would then probably, I think I'd probably just add some peas. That would be my, I just love peas in an egg fried rice. I just think it's the most delicious combination. And I didn't really add any spices. I like the simplicity of just, you know, that real decent hit of ginger. And then I'd add my rice, kind of move that around the pan. If I was adding an egg, then I would push all the rice, you know, and obviously you have to really cook the rice to make sure that it gets nice and hot all the way through.
Yeah.
That you know, you can keep adding a bit of oil so it gets those kind of crunchy sides. But obviously, getting it really, really piping hot is the key thing to make sure it's not dangerous.
Yes.
And then the egg, I just move all the rice over to one side.
Yep.
And then I whisk an egg again with a little bit of soy and then kind of pop that into the pan and give that a little sort of twizzle around as if I was making an omelette in the corner. Yeah. And then slowly fold that in and then obviously pop the tofu on top. And then I'd always try and serve that with some nuts of some kind, so
yes,
peanuts, cashews, to give it a bit of extra texture, some herb if I've got it around. I've had terrible luck growing coriander, so
it's been a difficult year for coriander, actually.
Yeah. But I have to actually buy coriander from the shop, but I always have some of that in. So some coriander. And then there's such amazing chili oils around these days. And those kind of, there's some brilliant products called Ryu, which is, I don't know if you've tried them, based on a kind of Japanese chili oil kind of nut preparation. And they are so, so delicious. So quite often I will have some of those kind of, you know, crunchy chili oils where they've got a bit of shallot, a bit of, you know, five spice, a bit of chili, and drizzle that over the top. So that would be, yeah, that is a very, very frequent dinner for us.
Fabulous. And never, because I don't know about Ryu, so I use toasted sesame oil. But I mean, I guess it's sort of the same kind of thing.
It is, yeah. The sesame oil, yeah, is delicious, and I would add that in. But if I was, these chili sort of oils are so fantastic. They're a bit like harissa or miso.
Okay. Yes.
They're the kind of thing that just sit at the top of your fridge for weeks, but add so much instant flavour to your food. I'm a huge fan of them.
Great. That sounds so good. I've got two or three others that I just wanted you to talk us through, but I wondered for this time of year, if you could give us maybe one or possibly two others, maybe a savoury and a sweet, of what you're going to be cooking in the next few days. You know, sort of straightforward family food, not party food, really.
Well, I love making sort of warm salads at this time of year because I feel like it sort of, it satisfies and also feels fresh. And so I've been getting we've had some watermelons from Italy in the shops, which is always quite exciting, especially for my son because he loves watermelon. And there's a salad I make, which is in the book, which is sort of roasted potatoes. So I roast them with some oregano, a whole head of garlic, and then kind of pull those out of the oven and then serve them in a salad with some delicious tomatoes, which I would have just sort of roughly chunked up and then tossed, you know, as you do with tomatoes, with some salt and some lovely red wine vinegar, just bring out, you know, their kind of full flavour and roundness. And then some bits of watermelon to give that kind of, you know, real freshness, and some feta cheese kind of broken in.
Mm.
And then also some
sounds
kind of
amazing
mint, parsley, coriander, whatever herb you have around. I feel like lots of those green herbs, you know, it's lovely to be specific with them, but also if you've got a bunch, I think it's great just to use whatever you have rather than popping out to buy another one. So I've been making that a lot, actually, and
That sounds so good.
The buttery garlic cloves you can sort of squeeze over as well. And then I whisk those into a quick dressing of a bit of olive oil, vinegar, you know, maybe a bit of lime juice if you've got some hanging around. So love that one.
Yeah, gosh, that sounds good. That sounds good. And then, I mean, I actually picked out, but I don't want to force you to talk about recipes if you've got others, but I picked out the double ginger and apple cake, as that just sounds incredible, because ginger cake is obviously just completely amazing. And I adore apple cake. So there you've got a hybrid of the two, but in a sort of relatively healthy version. And so that for me just sounds like perfection.
That is, I have to say, that's one of my favourite cakes ever, I think. I love ginger and I love stem ginger. Yeah. So I love apple cake as well. There's something so comforting about how sort of, I don't know, the texture of the apples in an apple cake. There's something very, very comforting about it. And my friend, who's another brilliant chef called Anya Dunk, I don't know if you've heard of her. Lots of German cookery, and she makes the most fabulous apple cake. So the inspiration from this came from her. But yes, the cake is, you know, it's got that kind of feeling of a Jamaica ginger cake, that kind of real richness. It's got it's got a bit of powdered ginger, a bit of grated ginger, and it's also got, you know, lots and lots of chopped up stone ginger. So you've got a real, real hit of ginger.
Yeah.
And lots of dark kind of molassesy sugar. You can make it, you know, the vegetarian way with eggs, or you can make it the vegan way, which is that trick I talked about with the sparkling water and the bicarb.
Mm.
And then the apples are kind of peeled and they're cut a little bit like a Hasselback potato. So very thinly, but not all the way down. And then they're sunk into the top of the cake. So they cook all the way through and they're soft and buttery, but you get these kind of really big chunks of apple through. So no, I'm an enormous fan of that cake. I make it too much, I think.
That sounds absolutely incredible. And then there were two others that I picked out, but and again, I feel like I'm steering you too much, but there's the most amazing sounding lemon, tomato and cardamom dal, which just sounds incredible, because again, those three flavours have to be, well, and with the lentils have to be four of my favourite tastes. And then another is aubergine and peanut stew, and whichever you prefer, but I'd love you to talk us through one or other of those maybe.
Yeah, well, both of those actually are real favourites. The lemon, tomato and cardamom dal, I love dal, but I feel like in summer I sometimes want something a little bit fresher than the kind of traditional dals. So
yeah.
This was my kind of answer to that. It's got lots, it's a dal with red lentils, and it's made with sort of stock rather than lots and lots of coconut milk. So it's got that kind of fresher, cleaner taste.
Yeah.
And then at the end, a lot of fresh tomatoes are added. So fantastic for this time of year, and sort of a really, really healthy squeeze of lemon. And, you know, in the spice mix that goes in with the lentils at the beginning, there's a really healthy amount of cardamom. So,
yeah.
You know, that kind of heady cardamom and the lemon, the tomatoes all work really well together to feel like it feels like a summer dal, which I love. And then the aubergine and peanut stew, I guess the roots of that were probably something I ate when I was traveling in sort of North Africa. And it's that kind of using peanuts in a very different sense. So using peanuts really as a sort of main ingredient. So not as something just to sprinkle on top, but actually as your kind of protein in the dish. So using really quite a lot of them. And they when you cook them with the aubergine and a bit of extra peanut butter, lots of spices, some scotch bonnet chili, and I char the aubergine first, so it gives it this really kind of smoky round flavor. The peanuts, when you cook them in that kind of stewed way, have this brilliant kind of succulent flavor, and they almost feel like a, you know, I guess like a vegetable, which rather than, you know, a crunchy nut, which we're used to. Another good one. My son won't quite eat that one yet.
Oh, really?
So okay. It doesn't get eaten quite
doesn't
as much.
Doesn't get made so much.
Scotch bonnet is a bit beyond his palate.
It'll come to him. It'll come to him. Honestly, I could go on chatting to you for hours, but I suppose there's one final thing which I made a note of when I was reading the book. And then I'm sure there may be one or two other things that you want to talk about. But the thing I remember when you came and did your demonstration here was your incredibly clever use of toppings. And actually, you just said, you reminded me of that just now, because you said you're not using the peanut as a topping. But that's one of the things that I feel that is a real one of your real threads, which is whereas most of us might make like a cauliflower soup or something, you will, which is nice, but you then go an extra mile, which actually turns something that's really, really good, excellent home food to something that you could serve in any restaurant anywhere. And that's genius. And I guess that's partly your background. I mean, I'm not going to go into the whole Jamie Oliver thing, but everybody, you know, Anna trained in the Jamie Oliver program, and so she has a restaurant background. But I do think that that is genius, your topping thing. Will you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely, I'd love to. Well, I think that the topping thing, you're right. I think it is what sort of sets restaurant food apart from home food. And yeah, I think quite a lot of home cooks are really good at sort of the flavour element, at sort of balancing the flavour. And I think people are much more open now to the fact that there has to be a bit of, you know, acidity, sweetness, all of these things within our food. But I think it's the texture bit, yeah, that quite often home cooks don't think about. And I think so quite true. Often that is where the toppings come in. And a restaurant chef will always, you know, they'll always have their soup, but then they'll have a few things to go on top, or they'll have, you know, the salad, and then they'll have what they call garnishes. I'm not a huge fan of the word garnishes because I think it just feels, it makes something feel like it's, you know, it's only there for that purpose. And I'm much more about things that are holistic and you can eat the whole thing. But
yeah,
so I really think that's what sort of is the icing on the cake of a sort of a bowl of soup or a stew or something. And I also think it's, yeah, about the choreography of that recipe. You know, if you've got sort of 40 minutes and you've got your soup bubbling, then why not use 5 minutes of that time, yeah, to quickly chop something? And yeah, as long as the recipe is written in a smart enough way that you're not kind of adding on an extra 10 minutes, that you're really just using that cooking time wisely,
yeah,
hopefully it doesn't really add too much, you know, work. And of course, it's something you can always skip if you want to, if you're in a rush. But I think, you know, if we can sort of think about that last finishing touch, I think it does really transform food.
Yeah. I so agree. So before we conclude, is there anything else that you wanted to tell us about that I haven't drawn out of you in a way that's important to you?
Oh, well, no, it's been a really lovely conversation. And I think, you know, it's lovely to talk about the book and talk about the kind of wider way that it's woven with sustainability and joyous recipes. But I think always the, you know, the sort of joy and connection of cooking is the main thing. And there is actually, I've put together a sort of online course recently, which I think has been really exciting, because I think one of the things that I've always feel a bit frustrated with in the books is just that sort of those moments when, you know, as a good cook and you as a great cook, Sarah, I think lots of people listening to this podcast are all probably very accomplished cooks. But for some people who are really learning, you know, that moment when the onions are the right brownness, or,
yeah,
you know, that moment when the mustard seeds pop in the right way, you know, yeah, being able to explain those exact moments, I think, on paper, yeah, is sometimes challenging. So this course I've done, which actually has been quite... was really quite fun, because it meant I could really show people the real minutiae of cooking. And so that's been a sort of exploration into kind of vegetarian cooking and cooking really without a recipe, which is something I feel quite passionately about. I'd like
people to
walk away from my book and, yeah, you know, not really reference the recipes, but just have ideas and things to kind, yeah, of throw around, because I think that's the key to kind of good cooking, good nutrition, yeah, good health, but also not wasting and, you know, having respect for, yeah, our foods.
And not making it another stressful kind of looking at a screen or a book. You know, it's just being free to be creative. I couldn't agree more. I mean, much as I really love your book, I what I want from it is to re-educate myself a little bit and how I cook into new skills and new tastes and new ingredients. And that's why I'm going on holiday and I'm going to take it. And I really want to just imbibe the whole thing. And hopefully, just as you say, come out at the end of that time where my repertoire has slightly changed and been slightly educated by it. But I don't want to go back to the book in a funny way, because it is that sort of, oh, okay, a tablespoon. Oh. Mm-hmm. And it's so slavish, isn't it? And so stultifying in a way.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's the same with gardening. It's all about, you know, it's about instinct, and it's about learning, and it's about repetition and all of those, you know, wonderful things. And I think, you know, if we can develop that, then you know, that's the key, isn't it? But yeah, I definitely need to develop my gardening instinct a bit better.
Well, I mean, you will when you're not so busy. Actually, busy is the last thing I wanted to talk about. Is I don't know about you. I'm exceptionally bad at work-life balance. I just find I love my work so much, so I end up doing too much of it. And at this time of year, which is holiday time for all of us, really, I know you're a great fan of Cornwall. Is that how you're going to just turn the phone off, don't think about recipes?
Absolutely. Well, we will be going down to Cornwall for a few weeks, a few weeks this summer. And actually, I think this last year has made me better at pulling back from work a bit. And that's been through necessity because, you know, my son was at home and I was sort of, you know, homeschooling him for a chunk of the year. But also because I think I've been used to being at home a bit more and not being, you know, I used to sort of run in the door at 7 o'clock and, you know, sort of, you know, rush to put my son to bed quite often. And now we're at home, you know, that evening meal has become non-negotiable. So I think in some ways I've sort of got a little bit better at the balance this year. We'll see as things, as things begin to change back
again. I've definitely
got
worse.
Have you? I think this summer I'm hoping to take a good few weeks off and just really
recalibrate, really
kick back and go down and discover some of the wonderful kind of restaurants and growers and wonderful food scene in Cornwall, which is so exciting at the moment.
Good. Oh, Anna, I can't say how much I've enjoyed chatting, and literally I think I could talk all morning, but I guess we ought to stop. And thank you so much for being here, and it was really, really lovely to talk.
Oh, thank you. I've enjoyed every second.
And I couldn't more passionately recommend your book. One, and I'm going to try and say it, Pot, Pan, Planet. And it's marvellous. It's truly, truly marvellous.
Oh, well, thank you, Sarah. It's been a joy to chat to you, and I hope to come back to your garden sometime soon.
That would be so nice. See you. Bye.
Lots of love. Bye.
Thanks so much for listening to Grow, Cook, Eat, Arrange. And next week, we're moving from food back to sort of objects. And Arthur and I are going to talk about things that we love in our summer garden that aren't plants. So it's kind of which is the best candle, which is the best pot, or our favourites, which is the best buckets, that kind of thing. Stuff that we might have found over the years from kind of bric-a-brac and sort of junky antique shops. So see you then.
You can find more information, photos and advice sheets on all the plants and recipes that we talk about in this podcast by heading to the links in the show notes or on our website at sarahraven.com.